Now I have the great honor of introducing one of my favorite writers who I've known for these past 2 years. We took English 201 together, and then somehow I found myself in 303 with you again. But Kira's writing is very strange. She has introduced me to half-human, half-alligators, mostly half-human, half-reptiles, because somehow you keep bringing the reptiles back. Yeah, and also helped me really realize that someday as I grow older, I will lose grip of my capability to control how much I need to pee. So thank you. So, but Kira's writing is stunning, and it's amazing that someone who's just a sophomore, now a rising junior, can produce such magnificent work and is already published, including in the Potluck magazine. So I'm very excited for you to hear a piece from Kira. Thank you, everybody.
Just a quick note, I didn't pee myself. I wrote a story about it. I haven't peed in public in a while, and I don't want anybody to start any rumors, so thought I'd talk that out. I am going to read a little piece from a short story I wrote called Calling Hours, and then after that, if you guys can stick it through, we can all eat cake, so even if you're bored, just let it happen. I too want to do a dedication to my fathers who had to live every day in this world that I've written about for many, many years. So, it starts in 1982. An alligator under a home is a harbinger of death in New Orleans, but by the time an alligator crawled beneath Beau O'Coin's front porch, the man was nearly gone. The reptile crept beneath the oak planks and marinated itself in the dust of Louisiana that pushed between cracks in the floorboards by the thick soles of work boots. Todd Becker had not set foot onto Beau O'Coin's porch Beau O'Coin's lawn before he was greeted by the true nuisance, the 70-year-old neighbor who'd called Louisiana Fish and Wildlife 16 times in 2 hours, complaining that she couldn't tend to the hostas on the side of her house with the creature under the neighbor's deck. "You gonna have to get him out of there, sugar," the white-haired neighbor pointed to the front porch. "I tried to ring the owner 10 times, but I didn't see one light go on. That's why I kept calling." "I'll take a look, ma'am," said Todd, who peered through the slats beneath Beau O'Coin's front porch to see the complaint. The 4-foot reptile was still in the shade, its eyes forward and glazed. This was the animal that tore up the phone lines of their department, that caused profane outbursts from his boss, which possessed such volume and fervor that they made the whole office jump. The onslaught of calls began at 8 a.m., the minute the office opened, and persisted until 1:14 p.m., when the director bellowed at Todd to see to it. "I think he got himself stuck down there." "Looks like it, ma'am. He'll probably be all right now, huh?" "Sure, he'll be fine. He's small enough that we can just release him." "Where are you from, babe?" "Not from here." "Minnesota, ma'am." "Well, ain't that something? You don't have to call me ma'am either. Call me Rhoda." Rhoda gasped when Todd looped a harness around the small gator's snout and pulled the spinning creature through the slats on the side of the porch. She coached him through the process, reminded him to be careful, and jumped when the scaly snout emerged, covered in debris, into the sunshine. The entire procedure took 15 minutes, but would have taken less had Rhoda not commanded Todd stop and listen to the coughing upstairs. "Pneumatic, babe. Only 28, you know that?" "That's young," Todd said. The cough sounded like suffering as it rang through the open window and into the driveway. "Can't get out of bed. Fairy lover of his comes and takes care of him. Ain't that awful? He hasn't tended that garden of his in the backyard for 4 months now." "Huh," Todd said. Rhoda paused. It was rare to find a person in New Orleans so inclined to so few words, even if he was from out of town. "You ain't a fairy, are you?" she asked. Well, that's okay. You don't have to tell me. You don't know him, do you?" "No, I will get along just fine so long as you get this gator out from his porch and don't give me any of that gay cancer, honey. I wouldn't dare." An hour later, Todd set the alligator on a patch of grass that sloped gently toward the green water of the swamp. The animal shot into the water, the rhythmic swerve of its spine reminiscent of a snake, and after gaining some distance away from his captor, found a cypress log on which to bask. From his perch, the alligator's eyes gazed at Todd, forlorn. As an omen, it had failed. Bobo Coin was soon to die, and it seemed the creature was the last to know. You didn't see him. Oh, time passed. I'm gonna take after Carrie. You didn't see him, did you? Ian asked when Todd revealed he'd visited Bobo Coin's front porch. Ian leaned against the fridge and ran his fingers through his hair. It's too hot in here. You'd think we could afford air conditioning with how much you work. He couldn't come out, Todd said, cutting celery in rhythm to a tape playing in the next room. And there was Rhoda. Who's Rhoda? The next-door neighbor with a phone problem. Bo was a fairy indeed, the sort that could teach you how to fly. Bo and his partner Gabe taught Todd how to go about being gay in the South nearly 10 years ago, while Todd was still a student at Tulane. Todd knew the sound of Bo's laugh and his Cajun way of speaking that fit his baritone so well. Bo gave him cooking lessons when Todd first moved to New Orleans and taught him everything he needed to know to make dinner for 2, for 6, for 18. He taught Todd the proper way to tell a story. It must contain something of a paradox and must begin with the line, "Y'all ain't gonna believe this." You could have seen him. You were at his house, Ian said, pacing back and forth in the kitchen. Gabe said he looked bad. I just want to see for myself, you know? She knew about the gay cancer. Todd scraped the celery from the cutting board into a pot on the stove. It was Bo who had taught him the holy trinity of Cajun cooking, celery, onions, and bell peppers. He scraped the father into the pan, took out 2 suns, and peeled off their outer layer of skin. The red and green Holy Spirit would have to wait until the first 2 boiled down in the broth. Couldn't you have just asked to visit him, even for a minute? Ian, even if I could, I couldn't have, Todd said, opening a package of gray prawns and laying them out on the cutting board. I can't have everyone knowing that you're gay. You must be pretty cautious, then, hiding me from an old woman like that. It's not that. It's, if you want to hide me, Todd, you're going to have to do a hell of a lot better than Ian, not you. Todd put down the knife and gave Ian a kiss on the forehead. Todd treated kisses on the forehead like a baptism, a reversal of his Lutheran upbringing. His lips touched Ian's forehead, and Todd renewed his love for the man as if it was his first encounter with tenderness. He smelled the light scent of Ian's shampoo as he brushed his hairline with his nose, and he held Ian's face between his hands. The stubble tickled the tips of his fingers. Not you. Never you. What then? People think I know every gay man in this goddamn city, Ian. We do. And if they know we do, then they'll think we might be liable to, you know, catch AIDS. The rich brown broth bubbled over the side of the pot and sizzled as it ran down the iron and onto the stovetop. The metal wheezed and the concoction let off a light smoke. Todd bent over it and pursed his lips together. He blew the smallest, coolest stream of air he could to calm it when he felt Ian's hands slip into the belt buckles on either of his hip bones. Ian's breath chilled the back of his neck, and he whispered into Todd's ear, "What say we go out dancing tomorrow night?" Todd turned around. "I don't see how that'd help Bo O'Coin." "Well, I'm not in love with Bo O'Coin, am I?" That's all I got right now.